work, at home, or on the road, you deserve great coffee. A Heine Brothers coffee subscription plan gives you top quality organic and fair trade coffee delivered right to your door or office automatically. You select the frequency, the quantity, and the variety of coffee, and Heine Brothers will take care of the rest, shipping included. Also makes a great gift, so order online at heinebroscoffee.com. That's HEINEBROSCOFFEE.com /subscription, and use the offer code THEPAST for $5 off any gift subscription. So what you're telling me is there's 29 days in February in 2020? I just don't think there's any science to... Oh, it's all science? Oh no, we're on. Hey, everybody, my name is Mick Sullivan, and this is The Past and the Curious. Thank you for joining us. I'm excited to welcome a few friends to this show. In the first story, you're going to hear a little bit of Dustin Barron's voice, along with a whole lot of his mandolin playing. It's a fun story about the Harlem Globetrotters, who weren't from Harlem at all. You'll also hear the story of Robert Smalls, who was an incredible man with an incredible story. The voice you'll hear telling that story belongs to my friend Jermaine Fowler. Jermaine is based in my hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, and has a podcast called The Humanity Archive. For parents and advanced listeners, it's a really thoughtful and well-researched look at some big people and big moments, which asks some big questions. And personally, I'm a big fan. So I'm glad he's here. Just a reminder that the 144th anniversary of the strange event called the Kentucky Meat Shower is coming up on March 3rd. If you're looking for a way to celebrate with me, I'm going to do a live reading on Facebook Live that day, March 3rd, at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'll have more details at the end of the show and also on Facebook. The Savoy Ballroom was a jewel of Jazz Age Chicago. The theater opened in the 1920s, just before people in the United States were hit by the Great Depression, which left many Americans poor and hungry. Throughout the difficult time, the Savoy was a place to find joy. On the south side of Chicago, the building was regularly filled with residents from the largely African-American neighborhood who gathered to dance to some of the biggest stars of the day. Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and Louis Armstrong were just a few of the people who banged out tunes as people jived across the giant dance floor. That dance floor was so big that it actually doubled as a basketball court for the Savoy Big Five. In the late 1920s, the five-man team hosted games to fill the slow nights in the ballroom. A young man named Cab Calloway would sometimes sing during halftime, but back then, basketball wasn't very popular. People cared about contests like horse racing and boxing and baseball, not the five-on-five game that depended on getting a ball through a hoop. It was a long way from the sport we know. Much slower, and much lower scoring than today. This team from Chicago would eventually work to change that, but their Savoy audience could never have guessed how. At some point, there was a dispute among the players of the Savoy Five, and they broke up. Three of them, led by Tommy Brookins, started a new team and renamed themselves the Globetrotters. It was an era of barnstorming, and when not at the Savoy, they set out from Chicago to tour the Midwest region of America. There were no organized leagues of teams and players in the 1920s and 30s. Instead, semi-professional teams would travel from town to town and earn money playing teams from whatever town they were in. Sometimes businesses might have a team of employees, so a barnstorming team like the Globetrotters might play against some guys who had spent the whole day assembling cars, canning vegetables, or even driving taxi cabs. Other times, barnstormers might play a team made up of members of a religious group like the House of David. Those guys never shaved, so they played basketball with beards down to their bellies, making James Harden's beard look like a 5 o'clock shadow. Soon, a young Jewish immigrant named Abe Saperstein entered the picture with the Globetrotters. Abe was a terrible basketball player, but his other skills were valuable. He knew a lot of people who did bookings in many of these towns. And more importantly, he had a car. These five teammates and their manager Abe would pile into his Model T like sardines in a tin can and hit those cold, slick winter roads. It was the 1920s, and they understood that random people in random Midwest towns might be surprised to find that all five members of the team coming to play their local guys were African Americans. There were very few professional sports comprised of African Americans at this point, so they decided to alter their name to help people know what to expect. At the time, the most notable and best all-black basketball team was known as the Harlem Rens, which was short for the Harlem Renaissance. In the 1920s and early 30s, the New York neighborhood of Harlem was an epicenter of black culture, and it was a time referred to as the Harlem Renaissance. People knew about these incredible artists and musicians who lived there, along with the writers like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. So the Globetrotters, who were very much from Chicago, asked themselves,
"How do we make ourselves sound dignified, worldly, and clearly a team of African Americans?"
Ding! The Harlem Globetrotters.
Will it matter that we're not from Harlem?
Nope.
That we've never trotted around the globe?
Nope.
Super nope.
Cool. Let's pile into a small, unheated car and go beat some people in basketball.
And they did just that. It was remarkable how good they are. They beat nearly every team from Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, and anywhere else they went. Then they'd pile back into the car and head on down the road to the next game. Throughout the 1930s, the team built up quite a reputation. They might have been the best basketball team in the world. No one agrees on how the famous tricks came into the game. A popular explanation is that they'd slip into the fun and flashy dribbles and drives after they safely put plenty of points on the board against their opponent. This did several things. One, it entertained the audience once the actual threat of competition was gone. No one wants to watch a blowout, so a fun show of tricks kept the locals entertained. But also, no one wants to watch their local fellas get trounced. A group from the city coming in and whooping the home team can really anger a local audience, and the Harlem Globetrotters knew this. Trick plays would thrill any crowd and win them over. The focus slowly became not about the final score, but about how much fun it was to watch these incredible athletes and their astonishing and often humorous approach to the game.
"First we win, and then we clown,"
Abe Saperstein once said. Now, most people agree that the real clowning didn't start until a man named Goose Tatum joined the team. Goose was an incredible athlete who could put the basketball through the hoop with ease, but he also had a keen eye for comedy. He found inspiration in funny movies and carefully watched the acts of clowns and other entertainers. His favorite gags would show up on the basketball court. Sometimes Goose would tiptoe over and pretend to spy on the opposing team's huddle, all the while making sure the audience was in on the joke. Other times, he'd hand the refs a trick ball after a timeout. Upon dribbling the ball, the ref would grow angry because the ball never bounced back up. It just plopped, devoid of air, on the ground. Sometimes, Goose would disappear from the court altogether while the game continued, only to be found in the audience eating popcorn. He even had a bit where he would pretend to be knocked unconscious on the court. The refs and his teammates would try everything to wake him up, but no amount of shaking or poking or prodding would open his eyes. It was only the smell of his own stinky shoe that would get him back up on his feet again, much to the disgusted delight of the audience. In 1948, Abe Saperstein was with a friend who just so happened to own a basketball team called the Minnesota Lakers. The Lakers were the best team in the brand new professional basketball league, which would soon become known as the NBA. The league did not allow black players on any of their teams. Regardless of league affiliation and regardless of the color of the player's skin, each man believed his team was the best in the world. They'd never meet in a league as it was, so the natural solution was to stage an exhibition game between the Lakers and the Globetrotters. It didn't seem so to the men at the time, but a game between an all-white NBA team and an all-black semi-pro team would prove monumental. 18,000 people came out to watch, which was easily twice as many people as most professional basketball games would attract at the time. And despite the fact that the Lakers' star center, who stood 6 feet and 10 inches tall, was 7 inches taller than anyone else on the court, the Globetrotters won on a last-second shot. It was a powerful moment. The next season, those Lakers would go on to win the national championship. But when they played the Harlem Globetrotters a second time for a second exhibition between the two teams, the Globetrotters came out on top yet again. The following year, the NBA ended segregation, and 3 of those same Laker-whooping Harlem Globetrotters, Chuck Cooper, Nat Clifton, and Hank Dazzone, became three of the first four African Americans to join the league and play professional basketball. This was 1950, 3 years after Jackie Robinson had broken the color barrier in baseball. The Globetrotters still continue their entertaining shows today, keeping the spirit of barnstorming alive. They get a lot of credit for how they support communities and bring joy to so many and educate kids about health, but it's easy to forget about how important they were in integrating professional basketball. They now tour and play with just one team, often known as the Washington Generals. According to most sources, the Globetrotters have beaten the Generals over 16,000 times. How many times have they lost, though? That question is harder to answer, but it's just a few. The most recent Globetrotter loss was way back in 1971 when both teams lost track of the score. When the clock expired, the Generals were ahead. That was not supposed to happen, and people expected the Globetrotters to win, and it's usually agreed that they will. Today, it's all about the show, the fun, and the love of basketball, not the competition. This is what made that loss so shocking. Reports from 1971 say the stands were filled with silent, shocked faces, and even a few crying children. Luckily, it's been smiles for all since then.
We're the All Creatures Podcast. Each week, Angie and I explore and share amazing details about the many animals we share our world with.
Plus, Chris and I are both PhD scientists and educators. So we do the deep dives in the scientific research and then come back and share what we learn in a fun and casual way. We also speak with other scientists, animal experts, activists, and many other conservation enthusiasts from all over the planet.
So you can find the All Creatures Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for You Have 30 Seconds with a great story about an awesome person. I'm so excited to hear from you. Emily, take it away.
Hi, my name is Emily, and I live in Chicago, Illinois. I think Nellie Bly was a really cool reporter because she went into the middle of action. An example of this is when she went into a psychiatric hospital for women. It wasn't a very nice place. The article that she wrote about the hospital was called 10 Days in the Madhouse. I think Nellie Bly was really awesome and should influence everyone.
Couldn't agree more. Nellie Bly is super awesome, and thank you for sharing. I recommend everyone else go out and learn more about Nellie Bly. We featured her on the podcast before. If you would like to do a You Have 30 Seconds, all you need to do is figure out a story, whittle it down to 30 seconds, record it on a phone, and email it to me. The instructions are on the website, thepastandthecurious.com. And now, I think it is...
It's quiz time! It's quiz time! It's quiz time! Time!
Yes, indeed, it is quiz time! And these are all about the Harlem Globetrotters. Do you know which Hall of Fame NBA star got his professional start with the Globetrotters? Hint, his nickname was The Stilt. After leaving the University of Kansas, Wilt Chamberlain joined the Harlem Globetrotters for the 1958 season. This was the year the team traveled as ambassadors to the Soviet Union and where they met Russian leader Nikita Khrushchev. In the NBA, Chamberlain set a record by scoring 100 points in a single game, but he said his year with the Globetrotters was the most enjoyable of his career. All right, question number two. Do you know which cartoon featuring a team of crime solvers and their often accidentally helpful dog featured the Globetrotters as guest stars several times? The basketball team had their own Saturday morning cartoon from 1970 to 1972, and to cross-promote, they made several appearances on the more successful cartoon called Scooby-Doo. They were also guests on the show Gilligan's Island. Question number three. How tall is the tallest person to play for the Harlem Globetrotters? Paul Tiny Sturgis, a player originally from Great Britain, is 7 feet and 7 inches tall. He joined the team in 2011 along with another player who was a full 2.5 feet shorter than him at only 5'1". Paul was only with the Globetrotters for a couple of years, and then he played with the NBA developmental leagues. But he ultimately joined the Globetrotters' nemesis, the Washington Generals. During the game, he wears a burglar's mask to add to the humor.
Very few people knew Charleston Harbor as well as Robert Smalls. It was one of the busiest ports in the American South, and it was impossible for the city of Charleston, and much of South Carolina for that matter, to survive without it. At ports like this, ships would come and go, bringing goods, food, and essential supplies for the city. But while the water on the surface of the Charleston Harbor all looked the same, the hazards underneath could only be navigated by someone who truly knew their way around. In these waters, an inexperienced pilot could easily wind up with a damaged boat, find himself run aground or worse, suffer a capsized ship and sunken goods. Robert Smalls had more experience than most, and any boat was safe with his hand on the wheel. It was 1862, the second year of the American Civil War. South Carolina had been the first of several states to secede from the Union. In order to preserve the institution of slavery in that state, they wished to be a part of the United States of America no longer. They left to begin a new country, the Confederate States of America. South Carolina was eventually followed by 10 other states in attempting to leave the Union. The United States government, led by Abraham Lincoln, would not recognize the new offshoot republic and did everything in its power to stop it. This included surrounding Charleston Harbor in a blockade. The blockade was made up of several ships forming a ring around the city off the shore and the Atlantic Ocean. These Union ships stayed far enough away to be out of range of cannon fire, but still tried to stay close enough to the city and each other so as to catch any boats coming or going. Many of the Confederate ships still made it through. A smaller ship was more agile and could slip through the blockade at night, or time it just right and thread the needle between the two bigger, slower ships. But for the most part, the Union ships created a problem for the Confederates and citizens of Charleston. Robert Smalls knew this and was planning to steer the Confederate ship called the Planter straight to them. It was a dangerous attempt in many ways, but hanging in the balance was his freedom and the freedom of his family. Failure was not an option. Robert Smalls had lived on the McKee Plantation, where he had been enslaved since birth. His mother, a woman named Lydia Polite, had been enslaved there as well. As he was growing up, Robert was typically treated with favor compared to the other enslaved people on the plantation. Others did not enjoy the leniency he received. The boy spent so much time in the house on the property that his mother worried he might not truly understand the horrors of slavery. She made arrangements for him to spend time in the fields to see and experience the endless toils of the people around him. She made sure he was witness to the unfair and inhumane punishments that were a regular part of the life of the enslaved on the plantation. These memories would remain with Robert for his lifetime. By his adult years, Robert was working away from the plantation. He was still legally owned by his master, and as the laws of the time allowed, Robert was required to pay his owner most of his salary earned with his labors. Robert saved the little money that was left over in hopes of purchasing freedom for himself, his wife, and his children. At the rate he was working, it was unlikely he would be able to save even enough money to buy their freedom in his lifetime. The slave system was cruel and unfair. One of his first jobs had been as a lamplighter on the streets of Charleston. Before electricity flowed through wires to power the lamps and brighten the streets, it took a person to bring light to the darkness. Most lamplighters of the time would walk the streets with a long stick at the end of which was a lit wick. At dusk, he'd make the rounds to each of the lantern poles on corners and between city blocks, lighting the tall gas lanterns. As the sun rose, he'd make the same path, this time with the snuffer on a long stick to extinguish the flames inside each public light. From there, his next job would take him to the waterside of Charleston Harbor. He worked as a shoreman, unloading the cargo ships. Next, he worked as a sailmaker and then eventually began working on the boats themselves. His intelligence and great mechanical instincts helped him eventually earn a position as a wheelman, essentially a boat pilot. He was one of the best around. The Planter was a cotton boat that had been pressed into service for the Confederate Army. Sometimes, with Robert at the wheel, it would sneak through the blockade to retrieve gunpowder, ammunition, or other essentials for the Southern soldiers. Robert was not alone. There were several other enslaved men as denied their freedom while working against their will on board for the Confederate Army. And several of these men noticed something. Robert Smalls looked a lot like the captain of the Planter. Robert agreed. He and the Confederate captain had the same body type, even similar features and posture. The biggest difference was the color of their skin, which the darkness could easily mask. What might have begun as a frivolous notion, or at least a far-fetched idea, developed into a serious plan in Robert's mind. On the night of May 12, 1862, the plan became reality when the captain and crew disembarked to spend the night on shore. Just a few steps away from the docked ship, Robert and the other enslaved men stayed on board the boat. There must have been nervous gulps, deep breaths, or wringing hands, but if the tension was high, Robert couldn't show it. He put on a uniform jacket like the captain's and donned a straw hat that was favored by the captain as well. Positioned at the wheel, he mimicked the captain's posture with his own body. The others fired up the boilers to power the engine, and he steered the boat out into the harbor within eyesight of the captain's window. Being discovered would be a terrible turn of events for the escaping men, but so far so good. Before heading out to sea, the Planter made a single stop at another wharf farther down the bank. No one on shore had discovered the ship was stolen yet. Docked at the wharf, shadowy figures quietly, carefully stepped out onto the wooden planks and crossed over to board the moonlit boat. They were women, men, and children, the families of Robert and the other enslaved boatmen, risking everything to escape to freedom. In the harbor, there were checkpoints where watchful eyes kept tabs on ships coming and going. If discovered, their punishments would have been extreme, and they knew it. As they approached, Robert did everything he could to look like the captain. He folded his arms the same way, paced the deck the same way, and knotted the straw hat on his head. The 17 passengers, eager for freedom and terrified of being discovered, were not as cool as he. One later reported, "When we drew near Fort Sumter, every man but Robert Smalls felt his knees give way and the women began crying and praying." Fort Sumter, the exact site of the Civil War's opening hostilities, was now the last place Confederates might recognize something wasn't right on the boat as it passed by. But thanks to years of experience piloting Confederate boats past the same fort, Robert knew the signal they'd expect to hear. He'd give the signal one last time. If they were lucky, the passengers aboard the Planter would set out for the open sea not long after. He blew the steam whistle three times, two long and one short. The Planter passed Fort Sumter and left the Confederacy behind without incident. Safety was still no guarantee. Now they were approaching Union ships before sunrise in a Confederate boat. None of the fugitives were sure they would have made it this far, but if they expected the worst, they planned for the best. Robert's wife had brought with her a white bedsheet. Once out of sight of Fort Sumter, the people on board pulled down the Confederate and South Carolina flags from the ship's pole and hoisted a white bedsheet in their place. It was a flag of surrender, and they prayed the Union ships would see it before they opened fire on the Planter. There was a good chance they would identify the Planter as a Confederate ship trying to run the blockade. It was a gamble, but a good one for Robert to take. According to the Navy reports of the incident, a ship called the USS Onward caught sight of the Planter just as the sun began to rise. The Navy men on board opened the portholes and had cannons positioned to fire when someone on board exclaimed that they saw something that looked like a white flag. They held their fire, and in a short while, Robert surrendered the ship to the Union Army. He and his family were free. Once again, Robert had brought light to the darkness, and he'd do so for the rest of his life. Americans were captivated by the story of the men and women on board the Planter, and Robert Smalls was granted a meeting with Edwin Stanton, Lincoln's Secretary of War. Until that point, Lincoln and his officials had been unwilling to allow black Americans to enlist as Union soldiers. Robert Smalls had something to do with them changing their minds, and when Lincoln passed a measure months later, Smalls is said to have recruited 5,000 men to join the Union on his own. Smalls was given a reward by the Union in exchange for the boat he had recovered from the Confederacy. In the years after the war, he actually used that money to buy the very home his former master had owned. Robert Smalls went on to a significant career in politics, being elected to the U.S. House of Representatives for 5 terms. He died in 1915 in the very same house he had been born as a slave, in which he could then proudly call his own. His memory is precious to his community still, and his advocacy for African Americans was a light in the darkness of the racism they faced after the Civil War. Robert knew the truth all his life. All my people need is an equal chance in the battle of life.
And that was our 40th episode. That feels really awesome to say. We make this show in the midst of living our lives and doing everything else that we have to do, namely because it's so much fun, and we also think it's a really good thing to do for the world. Thanks to Jermaine from the Humanity Archive, to Dustin Barron, and to Emily in Illinois for the You Have 30 Seconds segment, and thank you for listening. If you are interested in supporting the show, you can support financially on the web platform known as Patreon, or you can simply leave a review, subscribe on any of your podcatchers, send us a You Have 30 Seconds segment, or follow us on social media. Just drop us a line to say hello, or tell someone about the podcast with your mouth. That would be an excellent use of your mouth. As I said at the top of the show, I will be doing a live reading on Facebook Live. I'll be reading the book that Shea Goodlett and I created called The Meat Shower. It's based on a real event that happened way back in 1876, and the anniversary of the date is March 3rd, so I thought that would be an appropriate way to celebrate. I hope you'll consider joining me. I think it'll be a lot of fun, and it's not anything that I've ever done before, so who knows what could happen. Like, have you seen the video when the dude is on the video call, like, with the national news, and he's talking to the talking head, and his little kid comes running in and causes havoc? It could be like that. I don't know. We'll see. If you would like to get a copy of the book, it is available online, but the best scenario is ordering it from our publisher, Early Works Press. There is a link on thepastandthecurious.com, or you can go to earlyworkspress.com/themeatshower. If you haven't heard it yet and you don't know what I'm talking about, you could go back to episode 32 of The Past and the Curious, called Strange Things, and you will learn about the meat shower, because you might want that context, because a lot of times when I start talking about the meat shower, people are like, okay, weirdo, but it's a thing, I'm telling you. Anyway, our next episode will come a little bit earlier than usual because it's a part of a Kids Listen Sweeps effort, and we want to get in the window of releases of shows from our other podcasting friends. Everybody's releasing on a similar theme within a week of one another. So look for that around March 9th. Just don't get used to 2 episodes in like 2.5 weeks. I'd lose my mind and my job and everything else if I tried to keep that up. Anyway, thanks for 40 fun episodes. There's plenty more where that came from. I'm Mick Sullivan. This has been The Past and the Curious, and thank you very much. Be nice to somebody. Be nice to everybody. One weird day in 1876, in Bath County, Kentucky, meat fell from the sky.
Meat?
Meat.
Meat?
Meat!
Yes, meat. And in 2019, we were weird enough to write a book about it. Not just any book, because we can't do anything normal. What we decided to do is pretend that the only surviving piece of meat in the world, which really does exist, yeah, we made him the narrator of our story. I can't wait to share it with you. It is called The Meat Shower. It is available now as we speak, or as I speak. I don't know if you're talking right now or not. As you listen and as I speak, it is available now. You can go to our website, thepastandthecurious.com, or the publisher's website, earlyworkspress.com, for more information.
The Meat Shower.